My next guest is Dr. Emily Isaacson, who serves as the Artistic Director for the Oratorio Chorale and the Maine Chamber Ensemble, a symphonic chorus and professional orchestra in Maine. Last year, she launched the Portland Bach Festival with faculty from the Juilliard School. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've had a very interesting career for a Maine woman. I mean, you're doing some things that I don't think as many people are doing who come out of Brunswick.
I feel really lucky for the adventures I've gotten to take. I feel very lucky for the opportunities. And I'm excited to be back doing it here.
Well, tell me about why music became important to you as a younger person, because obviously this is something you've been doing for quite a while.
So I have a 3.5-year-old daughter now who, according to my parents, looks, talks, and acts just like me. So I'm sort of getting a new vantage point of viewing my own journey. My daughter wants to perform everywhere. You turn on music and she's dancing, you say something funny and she's repeating it back as a play. And that was very much me. I was sort of captivated by art and music and theater and dance right from the get-go. Started doing Maine State Music Theater productions when I was in fourth grade. Huge debt of gratitude to Chuck Abbott, who was the director of Maine State Music Theater at the time, for teaching me not only about show business, but really about hard work and dedication and focus and being 9 years old and working with adults. And so I did a lot of Maine State Music Theater and theater project acting until I was about 12 or 13, and then I became an awkward, ugly teenager. And I lasted in that space for maybe till 35. No, just kidding. for a good long time. And so there was a summer where I auditioned for all sorts of plays and I didn't get in because I wasn't cute anymore. I was too young to play an adult role and too old to play a cute kid role. And my mom said, why don't you audition for the Bowdoin Summer Music Festival chorus? And I didn't want to do that. It was classical music and it was with my mom. That's not cool at 14, 15. But, you know, why not? So I did. And it just so happened that that summer they were doing a piece called Chichester Psalms by Leonard Bernstein, which is a gorgeous piece and is actually really important sort of in my musical evolution in terms of thinking about what music can do and be and sound like. It blew my mind as a composition. But it also happened to have a boy solo in the piece, a child solo. And I was the youngest person in the choir by probably 20 years. and so I got the part, which was great. And it was being directed by Jeff Malarski, who's now the director at Columbia University, but at the time was a professional percussionist at Philadelphia Orchestra. And then June Hahn was the harpist, who's now become a good friend. And she's with playing with New York Phil, and she teaches at Juilliard. Anyway, my point being, I got access to these musicians that were like in another stratosphere of creativity. And because I had this solo and because the piece was quite complex, I had a number of private coaching sessions with June and Jeff. And I have such vivid memories of being in this tiny little apartment space in Brunswick on Cleveland Street, and June and Jeff and I working together and feeling like I was part of art in a way I had never experienced before, that I was part of something transformative for myself and also expressive of something so much greater than the three people in this room and the little town of Brunswick. And I remember the performance for that concert, opening my mouth and hearing something coming from somewhere else and not recognizing it as my own. And during that concert, I said, I want to be a part of this for the rest of my life. And I don't know what that means. At that time, I didn't know whether I was going to be a singer or an arts administrator or a conductor. And I sort of spent the next 5 or 6, 7 years trying different things out through college. But I knew this is what I wanted to do.
Both of your parents are attorneys.
That's right.
And yet they're both very interested and involved in the arts.
Yeah.
It's kind of That's a fascinating blend that you have in your household and that the kind of the stock you come from.
I'm lucky, but I don't think it's that abnormal. One of the things that I love about Maine is that members of the community in all different sectors, business, medicine, law, education, are involved in all sorts of other sectors. And my dad always said growing up that one of the things he loved about Maine is that you could really be a part of the conversation and make an impact because of our scale. And I didn't really understand what he meant by that until I lived in Chicago and Washington, D.C., and then Boston, and started trying to become a part of the conversation, and there was no room. Unless you have, you know, three PhDs and gazillion dollars, no one really wants to talk to you. And in Maine, you can really make things happen. And I really value that about this community, and I value that the people in this community give back. So, you know, I'm now in a position where I'm doing a lot of development and fundraising, and I'm talking with people who are lawyers and CEOs and executive directors of other organizations. And that was very much what my parents were. The law was their career, and they loved that work. My dad is also a professor at Bowdoin, so he gave me that sense of curiosity. But they were always very involved in the community, whether it be things in the health board, medicine, or various art forms. So it's always been a part of my life.
You didn't originally know that you wanted to do conducting. This is something that came over time. And it's not something that those of us in the, I guess, in the regular world, the lay world, I guess we should say, necessarily think of when we think about music, unless we watch Mozart in the Jungle and then we think about conducting. But how did you come to this place?
You know, I think I came to it in the same way that other leaders sort of come to that vision. Both my siblings and my brother-in-law went to business school. And so there's a lot of conversation amongst them and their friends about being a part of a larger company or organization, but then this sort of desire to be the vision, be the one making the decisions, to build something of their own. And I started thinking that I wanted to do singing, that I wanted to, my college application letter was about wanting to be an opera singer, but also wanting to raise chickens, and that was going to be a dilemma because how do you, if you're an opera singer, you have to be in a big city and you can't raise chickens, or at least back then. I guess in Brooklyn, you can do it now. But so that's where I went in to college thinking. But as I was doing things, I realized that the musicians and the singers are the executors, that there is an incredible amount of talent. And frankly, I don't have the talent it takes to do those positions. But I didn't want to just execute on somebody else's vision. It started to become clear to me. I went to Williams College, and it started to become clear to me that I had a lot of ideas, some good, some bad, but that I wanted to be the one creating the vision and communicating it to other people. And that if I have any gifts, they are not in exceptional musical talent, although I'm not bad, but they are in my ability to communicate both as a musical leader and also as a member of the community and advocating for the arts. So I thought I would try that pursuit. And it has been very difficult, but so rewarding. And I'm so glad to not be in my 20s anymore. I'm glad to be here.
What does it take to become a conductor?
There's a simple and a complicated answer to that. So the simple answer is that you go to grad school and then you start working your way up the chain. But the reality is, and one of the things that made my 20s so hard is that as a conductor, you are expected essentially to be an expert in music theory, music history, diction, which means you need to be able to speak French, German, and understand Italian and Latin. You need to be able to play piano. You need to be able to sing. You need to understand all the instruments of the orchestra. You need to be able to communicate well speaking. You need to be able to write program notes and communicate well through writing. No one told me I needed to be good at business, but turns out that's a huge part of what I do now. And then on top of that, you need to know all the repertoire in your field and be able to wave your arms around. So my I have two masters and a doctorate, and my 20s were in some ways just a constant failure, which I now look back on grateful for the struggle. But at the time, it's hard when you are used to being a good student and succeeding at life, and then not having so much to learn that there's no way that you can learn it, and constantly failing, constantly being at the bottom of the food chain. And frankly, I have had some really wonderful personal mentors in my life, but music grad school is a really brutal place. I hear people at med school and law school talk about their experiences, and I can identify, except for there were only two of us in the class. And so it's sort of that level of brutal critique on a much more intimate, heightened level. So I have a number of graduate degrees, which were really helpful in learning the repertoire and some of those things, certainly music history, music theory, and moving your arms around in the repertoire. But I really feel like that's only about 50% of what I do now. I think my conducting technique has been greatly influenced by my training as a ballet dancer when I was younger, and also my training as an actor, largely by Al Miller and the Theater Project. You know, so much of it is about what you can communicate with your face, with your eyes, how you, I view myself is the first part of a reflecting mirror. So I am reflecting the emotions of the music and what's going on in the music in my body to the players. And then their job is to then reflect that in sound to the audience. But if what I'm showing the players is dead, then the musicians are going to be dead as well. So a lot of that is what Al taught me. And then I do a lot of business type stuff now, building organizations, marketing, development, fundraising, PR, that kind of stuff, and which I have zero training in, but I am loving learning on the job. It's been so fun.
Tell me what it's been like to be female in a largely male field.
Hard. I'm grateful to have my mother as a role model. She was one of 12 women in her law school class, and I grew up hearing war stories about that time, and also her arguing in front of the appeals court. So hearing stories like hers and other women around me was very helpful. But there weren't models in my field. So as I mentioned, I sort of realized I wanted to be a conductor by the time I was 15, and that was really solidified by the time I was in 20 and in college. And I went to take my first conducting class, and the professor, I was one of three students in the class, and the professor said, there are no good female conductors because women can't conduct. And then we spent 16 weeks together. So that was sort of my entree. And then I was very lucky to go get my first conducting degree with one of the few women teachers in the country, Sharon Paul out in Oregon, who is a magic maker. And it was also a really safe environment being out in Oregon. You know, in Oregon, everyone's a tattoo artist or a Pilates teacher or a meditation coach. And so the fact that I was a female conductor, like, no one cared. And that was a great area to be making mistakes and to be learning. But I applied for a number of graduate programs, both at the master's and doctoral level, where, I mean, all sorts of ridiculous things. Like, I would be invited to the audition, and then they would have, you know, meetings or parts of the audition behind my back and not tell me about them. So there's no way that I could, you know, compete for that. all part of what you do in music training is you go to graduate school, but you also go to all these summer programs. And so both my professors in graduate school, but also in these summer programs, the number of comments I got about my body and about the way I dress, which is fairly conservative. I'm like pretty conscious of that, but I've not really ever heard them make a comment about a man's body on the podium. And I've gotten pretty used to having those comments about my body, and I'm now trying to use it as an asset, but that was certainly a struggle. And I think the hardest part was, you know, I said I had these mentors in other fields, but not having people in my own field. Sharon Paul, my teacher in Oregon, was wonderful, but her career was a really different path than what I wanted. She led the San Francisco Girls Choir, and I'm not really interested in doing children's choruses, and that's what everyone assumes I want to do because I'm a woman conductor. But I want to conduct symphonic choruses. I want to conduct symphonies. I want to conduct big oratorios and concert works. You know, I love the huge requiems with the big orc. You have 150 people on the stage. Those are my favorite. It's so exciting. And that, it, you hardly ever see women up in front of 150 people doing that. And so I think what was the hardest for me was trying in this already extremely competitive field where, you know, 10%, 15%, 20% are able to make their living in it. So many people drop out or leave or have to switch careers that within that space already, how was I going to be able to raise a family, keep a marriage going, not be moving every 2 to 4 years, lead a fulfilling life outside of my career, and be a woman in that leadership position. And, you know, I'm so grateful. It was incredibly serendipitous that I got the job at Oratorio Corral. It, we've been around for 44 years, and 22 years in, the director left. And it just so happened, I was finishing my doctorate at the time and was sort of looking around. And it also just so happened that the Downeaster started going up to Brunswick, which is where my parents live. So I could bring my newborn baby with me, hand her over to grandma, and run off to rehearsal. But this has been such a rewarding community to be making really high level music, and I really push my musicians. But for the most part, they're very comfortable with me being a woman, and they value, I think, what some people consider feminine qualities, which I don't see as feminine qualities, but just as good leadership qualities, such as humility or inclusiveness or a willingness to admit that I'm not perfect and that I'm a part of the process. One of the things I've noticed in my other female colleagues is we tend to see each other as, we tend to see the people we work with as collaborators rather than being the sort of dictator in charge. And I think at the end of the day, that makes for better music and a better organization. So it's been a challenge, but we're getting there. We're getting there.
Is there a glass ceiling currently?
Yes, absolutely. With no good reason, but there is. Of the 103 arts organizations with the largest budget, I think it's something like 14 or 15 have women conductors. Of the big 22 that you think of, only one has a female conductor, Marin Alsop. There are, you know, repeatedly, there will be seasons, I mean, decades of seasons where there's no woman guest conductor. It's really still not happening. And I read an interview with Marin Alsop, who's the director of the Baltimore Symphony recently, and she said that when, she's probably in her like 50s maybe, and she said that when she was in grad school or in her training, she thought, okay, my generation's gonna be the one that breaks the ceiling, that changes. And then 10 years, 15, 20, 30 years later, it really hasn't changed. And how frustrating that is for her to see. And there's more training opportunities now just in the last few years. Marin Alsop has started a fellowship for female conductors. Dallas Opera is doing this really interesting program for female conductors. There's certainly more female conductors applying for and sometimes in the graduate programs, but they're not ending up at the top leadership positions. So there's still a ceiling to be broken and work to be done.
Tell me about Amazing Grace.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited about this concert. So this is a concert I'm doing with Oratorio Chorale, and so just to step back for a second. So when I had that moment at 15 where I decided I wanted to be a part of this amazing art, I also realized how many barriers there are to other people feeling that way. Because of my parents, because my parents fostered creativity and curiosity and a sense that the world was my oyster, and because they gave me direct entree to that art form at such a young age. I was going to Bone Sur Music Festival concerts in the Ergo on my mom's chest. It wasn't intimidating to me, but I realized how intimidating it was to other people and how uncool it was viewed pretty much between the ages of 10 and, I don't know, 40. I don't know when you get the bug again. So part of my mission has always been to tear down some of what I see as unnecessary restrictions to what is incredible music. And in both my jobs, both with Oratorio Chorale and Portland Bach Festival, a lot of my programming is geared towards that. How can we get audiences engaged, potentially interactive, multi-generations? How can we put them in unexpected settings so that you may be sitting listening quietly to music, but you're holding a micro brew in your hand or you're looking at the ocean while doing so? You know, classical music was not until Mahler, until the late 19th century, that's not the way people heard music. Bach's, all of Bach's secular music was premiered in Zimmermann's Kaffeehaus, which was a bar hall. And it was one of the few places that unmarried men and women could mingle and flirt and talk to each other. And it's in that setting that he premiered many of his works. And it's the same, you know, at Mozart's operas, everybody was drunk and it was like a dance hall. Everyone's playing around. You think of Schubertian salons, Schubert, and it was just a big house party that happened to also have incredible art. And so I've wanted to bring back some of that socializing, celebratory, easy nature. And so Amazing Grace is this concert that my hope is through listening, reading, watching, and feeling the audience experiences this music and a concert experience in a very different way. So it's the African American spiritual, and we're featuring a buddy of mine, Reggie Mobley, who Reggie and I got to know each other, 5 years ago or so. And since then, he has just skyrocketed in his career, and he is flying directly from Buckingham Palace, where he is singing for the Queen of England to Maine for this concert, which is so exciting. He'll be doing early music for her, which is what he's known for, with Sir John Eliot Gardner, and then coming and singing these spirituals with us. And this concert, one of the things that's really important to me is that we approach Bach and Mozart and Beethoven with this sort of academic ethos and this performance practice lens. And we don't always apply that to contemporary music or to music from our own country. And so I wanted, not just for myself and for the ensemble, but for the audience, to put these African-American spirituals in context. So we've worked really closely with Judith Castleberry, who's an African-American studies professor at Bowdoin College and an expert on this kind of music. And the concert follows the evolution of the spiritual in America. So starting in the plantations and the way it would have been sung in a folk style or congregational singing, what you sort of think of as call and response, but then improvised harmonization underneath that. And so to create the context around what that music, where that music was coming from, we're doing a number of readings by Frederick Douglass. And then we move into the sort of Fisk Singers generation, where this music was now being being concertized, thought of as a performance opportunity. And W.E.B. Du Bois was at Fisk University while this was going on. So we have some writings by him. We go through emancipation and then towards the 20th century and the civil rights, ending with the way that the tune Amazing Grace was used during the civil rights and Over My Head was used during civil rights. So there's reading, there's incredible art by Daniel Minter and Ashley Bryan, who are main artists who've been on your show. Judith is reading, Oratorio Chorale is singing, Reggie is making people weep in their seats, and music is coming from all sides. There's a lot of movement in this concert. So it looks absolutely nothing like what you're probably expecting.
Well, with your very busy schedule, I really appreciate your coming in and talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Emily Isaacson, who serves as the Artistic Director of the Oratorio Chorale and the Main Chamber Ensemble.
Thank you so much.